This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Well, hello everyone, and welcome to another edition of Letters from Kayfabe. I'm here, as ever, with Alan. How are you doing, Alan?
Great, thank you very much. Another episode to go. We've got some great questions again this show. So, without further ado, shall we dip into the old mailbag, the old sack, and see what we've got?
Yes, just very quickly, if somebody wants to send a message to the sack, how should they go about doing it?
Well, the best way to send a message to our joint sack is by getting us on Twitter. I think for me, it's at Alan_Cheapshot. That's spelled A-L-L-A-N. And how do we get hold of you on Twitter, Parv?
I'm at Jerry Von K. That's the letter K.
We'll be back with the mailbag. Oh, and no doubt the mailbag has just arrived.
Well, if a postman delivered like that in England, I'd fire him immediately.
Right, so here we go with the first question this episode. It's Dear Alan and Parv, my favourite wrestler has always been Virgil. I remember seeing him once challenge Bret Hart for the WWF title, but no one believes me. Can you please prove once and for all that this actually happened? And that's from a long-time listener and writer of questions, Chadley Crisolo of Norwich, Connecticut. So, Chadley, we've moved now on to Virgil. I don't know, we were taking a dip maybe from the last episode. Did this actually happen, Parv?
Well, I want to say it's in late 1992 when Bret Hart was the champion. I think in that first reign after he defeated Ric Flair, he was doing the whole deal where he was the fighting champion.
Yeah, that was right. It was kind of like the workman's champ. He was putting himself in matches with various kind of jobbers, enhancement talent. So one of these was one of our favourite kind of wrestlers, you know, kind of people of this era for certain things, what he was up to around this time. This is Virgil, and he did have this match with Bret Hart. Virgil, everyone's favourite lonely wrestler nowadays, isn't he? I mean, there's, for the last like 5 or so years, we've seen Virgil sitting at waiting for autographs in bizarre places, and you know, always being on his own, bless him.
Still living off that December 91 feud with the Repo Man. Yeah, so, I mean, I actually did go back and watch this match. Have you seen it in recent times?
Yeah, I've seen the match. It's a fun match. It goes about 3.5 minutes. I mean, the outcome was never in doubt, really. But they had a good little fun match. Would you say it was a match anyone should check out?
No, I mean, only really to confirm that such a random thing happened, that Virgil had a title shot against a babyface Bret Hart while he was a babyface. I think that is the thing that you wouldn't believe. I think maybe one of the more interesting things to look at might be who else had title shots against Bret Hart during this time. I want to say that my bet is on Skinner having a shot.
I think you should just look this up now. And just before you know, as you do that, I mean, this was Virgil's only real major chance at a title in wrestling. He did, funnily enough, in 87, he held the AWA International Heavyweight Championship as Soul Train Jones at the time, and he defeated Big Bubba, who would go on to be Tugboat Typhoon and Shockmaster. So he had a title before, but he'd never really anything bar, you know, known as DiBiase's lackey.
What he did with the $1 million belt was quite a big deal.
Well, was it an official title? I mean, it was...
No, it wasn't sanctioned.
No, never sanctioned by Jack Tunney. So, really, it was a title only held by him and DiBiase, wasn't it?
And the ringmaster years later, yes.
Oh, yeah, of course, it was given to the ringmaster in there when he came in 96. So, I mean, the one thing to take from this match as well is Bret Hart, you know, we're going to talk about in a minute who else he worked against, but he did the whole pre-match handshake and the hug at the end to kind of show that Virgil is still all right by him and, you know, still cheer for Virgil. So I think it was good that Bret Hart in this area was kind of, you know, not putting them all, but elevating certain guys a little bit.
Yeah, so let's just have a little look at Bret Hart fighting champion, shall we?
Go on then.
So he beats Ric Flair on, this is, I want to say, the 12th of October, 92, okay? Bret Hart defeats Ric Flair. For a long time, that could only be found on Smack and Whack'em tape, I believe.
Yeah.
The very next night, his first title defense is against, any guesses?
Skinner.
The Berserker.
Ah.
Then he has a series of title defenses against Nails. all across the house show circuit, he's defeating Nails. Then Papa Shango.
Yeah, I do remember him having quite a few matches with Shango, actually, around this time.
Rick Martel has a shot. The Mountie has a shot. Virgil, who we've discussed. Kamala has a title shot, which is a little bit surprising. Rick Martel, around the horn, has a lot of attempts, as does Papa Shango. Shawn Michaels has a title shot, and of course that's at Survivor Series 92. And then lots and lots and lots and lots of matches against Ric Flair on his way out, all across the kind of December of 93 down the house show circuit.
You've got to see there, you know, just before the Ric Flair kind of run, as Ric Flair left the promotion, I mean, these matches on house shows, you had your WWF champion defending the title against Nails, you know, in the main event of house show. I mean, these shows surely, you know, weren't drawing that well at the time, you know, with that on top.
Well, see, I'd imagine that, well, that's a good point. What else would have been on those house shows?
We didn't have Warrior then.
About to say Hogan was on the car, but he wasn't, was he?
No, we had not a lot of anything, really.
Can we just pick out what random house
Undertaker.
This is from the Springfield Civic Center. This had Flair versus Bret on top. Let's see what was on that show. Okay, so this show was Bret Hart versus Ric Flair, Rick Martel versus Virgil, Skinner versus Jim Powers. For the IC title, Shawn Michaels versus Marty Jannetty. Jim Duggan versus Nails in a no contest. And the Head Shrinkers versus the Natural Disasters, with Max Moon defeating Repo Man in the opener.
God, that's a really weak card, that, especially on top.
That drew 2,000.
So. Well, yeah, that's what you're going to get with a card like that. I mean, this was the time WWF were really struggling on the road. You know, the talent had, you know, we've discussed in previous episode, had dissipated throughout, early 92. And they were, you know, in a complete rebuild process at this point. So this is the type of card you'd expect, you know, until you brought in your Razor Ramones and, you know, those guys like that as well who were coming up around this time. But, you know, it was, they didn't really find their stride really on the road for, you know, months.
Yeah, I mean, they did have Luger coming in just around the corner, who I guess is a bit more star power. But, you know, even that is essentially a WCW-made star, you know?
Yeah,
I mean, he just keeps on facing Flair again, until Flair leaves. Razor Ramon has a couple of shots. Bam Bam Bigelow. Lex Luger does have one shot against him in Canada. Fatu is getting shots.
As a single, as a heel single, really, because he was still in the Head Shrinkers at that point, wasn't he?
Yeah, so just, I mean, just like your Seeker takes on Hulk Hogan type deal.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he does face a lot of people, but I guess you can only defeat what's put in front of you, can't you?
Yeah, I mean, it's not Hart's fault at the time that WWF were in this kind of flux or, you know, change.
I mean, just while we're still on this topic, do you think it's I can see even like Erwin R. Scheister are getting title shots here. So, do you think it's any surprise that they did turn back to Hulk Hogan, you know, for one last go in 1993?
Well, no, not really. I mean, he'd been off TV for a year. And he was written out in a way that it did leave the door open for his return, because he did kind of say he was retired, but he didn't say how long for, if it was permanent. So when he did come back in 93, it was a shot in the arm. I mean, WWF then, like you said, Lex Luger was coming in, It wasn't great. I mean, it was so apparent that, you know, the drug policy or the drug testing or whatever changes happened really affected the on-screen roster.
Bob Backlund coming back is such a strange one, isn't it, at that time? Like, do you remember the pre-turn babyface Bob Backlund?
Well, you had Bob Backlund there. You had Terry Taylor as well, if you remember that, in 93, you know, running around. So it was guys who, you know, didn't have the bodies, the guys that they could work on. I mean, Backlund back in 93 is a whole kind of... Not another kettle of fish, really. We can, you know, bring that up. Hopefully someone may ask us a question about Backlund in this era, because there's a lot of interesting things we can really talk about.
Yeah, I mean, I hate to say this, but as a kid, I thought, like, Jerry Lawler was just a wimp, you know? Like,
yeah, I mean, Lawler, Backlund, Taylor, and you had guys like Damien Demento, who did much or nothing, really, on the shows. It was... Early 93 was an odd time. So just getting back to the question, though, Virgil, he was around still, you know, 93, 94. He went to WCW, I'd like to say, in 96, where he took the moniker of Vince, didn't he, in the NWO. That was his name, as a rib on Vince, because Virgil was, Vincent, you know, what Bobby Heenan, you know, called him as a rib on Dusty in WWF in 87. So yeah, it went full circle with that one. So yeah, Virgil, and as we discussed now, he's on Twitter. He's a bizarre fringe character in wrestling. I think he always has been, always will be.
Yeah, and of course, another thing that he's always been is Charlie Cuscolo's favourite wrestler. So.
Well, yeah, always. I mean, don't matter about your Dino Bravos anymore. It's always been Virgil.
So why don't we move on? What's the second question?
Second question, nice short question here. Dear Alan and Parv, who was Joe Fowler? And that's from Matt in Portland, Oregon. So Joe Fowler was a kind of footnote in WWF announcers stroke interviewers, wasn't he, Parv?
I think he's the sort of guy that a lot of fans either wouldn't remember, or because I think he gets kind of lost a little bit between the cracks. Does he appear on, I want to say he appears on SummerSlam 93?
Yeah, his first appearance in WWF was on screen in SummerSlam 93. I mean, his background was, before his WWF run, he hosted a show I've never heard of before called Knights and Warriors, which was a rip-off of American Gladiators. So that's where he kind of got his start. And he was sort of like the Vince... What Vince wanted around this time. He was enthusiastic, he was photogenic. I mean, Vince introduces him on as an interview segment before we interview Shawn Michaels. Vince's on commentary, and he says, now we're going to my newest, you know, guy, Joe Fowler. And Shawn Michaels interviews 123 Kid, and then finally on that show he interviews the driver of the Lex Express, who seemed quite incompetent, really, which you'd probably expect. But that was Joe Fowler's involvement in SummerSlam 93. But there's an interesting point, really, isn't there, about kind of why he's brought in at this time, Parv?
Yeah, well, why don't you tell the listeners what that is? Because we discussed this a little bit before we started recording today.
Yeah, we did. We discussed this off air. I mean, this was around the time that Gene Oakland was, you know, phased out or leaving to WCW a few months later. So his last pay-per-view was SummerSlam 93. So you can see Vince wanting to, you know, get a replacement, hit the ground running with Joe Fowler. It didn't quite work out, though, Parv, did it? I mean, his run was fairly short.
Yeah, I mean, his run basically lasts from SummerSlam 93 to Survivor Series of that year. So, super short run, roughly speaking, August to November of 93. He's mainly involved, from what I've seen, in these segments known as face-to-face, where Joe Fowler would introduce, if you can imagine, a cut screen. And then you've got, you know, a baby face on the left and a heel on the right, and they'd essentially cut promos at each other. So you'd get like a call and response type thing. Various different ones at this time: Razor Ramon, 123 Kid. I want to say there was one involving Doink that I saw. Somebody has actually collected them all and put them on YouTube. And Fowler is... How can I? I mean, I thought he was hideous, Alan. Did you watch any of this stuff?
I've gone back and seen the SummerSlam 93 bits for the purposes of this segment. But yeah, he was all over All American for about 3 months. He was the co-host with Bobby Heenan, kicked off in September 93. But he wasn't very good, really. He was very... he didn't have anything about him, really. I think that was a problem. He was... because I said I can't really say much about him. He was the co-host until I think it was November when Vince McMahon replaced him. And, you know, Survivor Series, I think he was on that show, and that was the end of him, really, in WWF and in wrestling altogether.
Basically, if I had to say anything about him, he tried a little bit too hard. It didn't
a bit too enthusiastic,
a bit
maybe.
Too enthusiastic, and it didn't come... You could tell that he was forcing it. Which is something that I would never say, for example, about my beloved Sean Mooney. They would say, I think that basically they went from Mean Gene Okerlund and Sean Mooney, a dream duo, to Joe Fowler and Todd Pangale in the space of a year.
Yeah, it did change somewhat. I mean, what Mooney left was early 93.
Yeah, WrestleMania 9 was his last assignment.
His assignments. You're like, he's waiting for his assignments of where he's going to go and what he's going to do. I can just imagine Sean Mooney with his wife at home, with his WWF bedspread, you know, that we've seen on Coliseum Home Video, funnily enough, you know, waiting for his next assignment that Vince is going to send him, Vince probably by telegram. You don't know, and off he goes to do it. Yeah, but Todd Pettingale around this time as well, he of pierced ear fame and kind of flat top head at some point with a rat's tail. He was a very archetypal 1993 annoying pitch man. You know, it lasted for some time as well. But Joe Fowler was actually, nowadays, he's been hosting a show on a channel called Shop HQ. And the show is called Home Solutions with Joe Fowler. And one of the shows, he actually, funnily enough, Parv, mentioned, or they mentioned his brief run in WWF in 1993. And they mentioned that Jim Cornette had called him Hatchet Head during a interview at SummerSlam 93. And Fowler, basically, now he sells hardware like table saws and paint sprayers. So that's what Joe Fowler's up to nowadays, folks.
Well, all the best of luck to him. I'm actually thankful that his run was reasonably short in wrestling, because I don't know, I don't think he was a right fit for what they were going for. I'd even say that Pettingale was a better fit for the product at that time than he was.
Well, after this, though, the we kind of deduced, didn't we, Parv, off air, that, you know, I'm sure listeners will let us know if we're wrong, that it moved more to Raymond Rougeau on this time after Joe Fowler left.
I think basically Raymond Rougeau got that slot, and we were trying to work out like what's the lineage of the Mean Gene role. And I think it basically ends up with Doc Hendricks. And then maybe even we're getting to like the coach and Kevin Kelly after that.
Yeah, it was, it kind of gone through some phases. I mean, Doc Hendricks was, you know, all right in the role, you know, more memorable than, you know, others a few years before him, you know, totally changed from Michael P.S. Hayes, one of your favorites, Parv, you know, into Doc Hendricks. But we had like people like DiBiase taking more of a commentary role around this time. There was a bit of a change in the commentary setup, you know, in general in WWF then.
Yeah, you've got guys like Johnny Polo around who host a show here and there and things like that as well. So, in fact, we'll have to return to this sometime, because the whole commentary scene of the kind of 93 to 95, 96 is a mess. And we need to kind of pick through that.
Charlie Wynn, or is it Charlie? I think it's Charlie Wynn, and we've got Stephanie Wyatt, like Todd Pettingale, you know, all over the show. And, you know, we moved into, you know, into the weird and wonderful Live Wire, you know, in 96, where we had Vic Venom, Vince Russo, and things like that. So
you've got guys like Stan Lane around, which is...
Oh, of course, yeah, in 95, yeah. Was he wearing his toupee at the time?
So, yeah, we will have to come back to that as a topic, I think. Time for one more, do you reckon?
Yeah, I've got one more of the questions before we go to JT. So the next one is, dear Alan and Parv, after Bobby Heenan stopped managing Mr. Perfect, he was managed at a time by Coach. What was that all about? And that's from Johnny Schumacher in Truth or Consequences, New Mexico. So we moved from Bobby Heenan, he stopped managing Perfect, as Johnny asked, and we moved to the coach. So who was the coach, Parv?
Well, the coach was a chap called John Tolos. A legendary wrestler in the LA territory. He had a very famous feud with Fred Blessie, of course, back in the early 70s. But he reemerges here because Bobby Heenan wanted to concentrate more on his broadcast career. And so, he gets Mr. Perfect, the coach, as the replacement to be the new Perfect manager. And, I watched some of this footage, the debut of the coach. And, being as kind as I possibly can, something about this didn't quite work. Would you agree?
No, I mean, look at the setup here. We had Mr. Perfect, Bobby Heenan, there were guests. Paul Bearer, and then we had Heenan introducing Coach, as Perfect's new manager, and basically, like you said, Parvin, saying that he's leaving management to pursue a full-time career in broadcasting, and Coach, I think he was completely lost. I don't know if he knew what was going on. I think he wasn't a good fit at all here for Mr. Perfect.
He says the word coach a lot in this. I mean, he's like, yeah, I'm the coach. And then he says it about 15 times, I counted, in about 3 minutes. It's a very, very awkward segment. And I don't think he ever really found his feet, did he?
No, I mean, he also, people remember him more for managing Mr. Perfect, but he also did manage the Beverly Brothers. They debuted the week after the initial taking over as Perfect's manager. They debuted in a squash match on the 22nd of June in 91. And there was like a video insert where the Beverly Brothers and Coach kind of were talking that he would take them to be the WWF Tag Team Champions. Generic interview. Yeah. Not much about it. So that was the Beverly Brothers as well. So, I mean, Coach John Tolos, as you said, he was someone with notoriety. I mean, I like that his finisher was simply when he was a worker was the knuckle grind to the temple, which is a nice basic finisher really. But in this period he'd been out of wrestling for years. I don't know why he came back. What specific reason it was? I don't know if any ins or outs of it, Parv.
No, I don't really know any of the backstage goings on. It just seems so random here in 1991 for this to be happening. I want to say that he may have been involved as maybe like he was doing some commentary with some of these smaller indie promotions that were going on, throughout the 80s, because there were always independent promotions around. And this is the sort of thing that a guy like John Tolos would be doing in this period. Maybe he'd do a stint here and there. But for all intents and purposes, in terms of mainstream, wrestling with any sort of notoriety, I don't think he did much at all between the end of his career and this point. So it's kind of strange. I do have a question, though, about the Beverly Brothers, now that you've mentioned them. One of the things that is a little bit strange about them is that their gimmick is not really that straightforward to me. Who are they meant to be? What's the idea of the Beverly Brothers?
To me, they're kind of like a weird throwback Hollywood team from the 50s. They've got some sort of weird kind of... I don't know. It's hard to kind of put. Did you kind of get my point?
They're supposed to be kind of like Beverly Hills set type guys, are they?
Yeah, sort of, but set like from the 50s or something. I don't know why.
The Golden Grahams or something like this. Like the because Bobby Heenan originally had that gimmick. Bobby Heenan's gimmick is essentially that he's from Beverly Hills and he's from a rich area. Nick Bockwinkel also had that as a game, the blonde bomber.
Yeah, they've got that kind of vibe about
them. The blonde
themselves.
Bombers were all about that.
I think that's a good comparison you made there, Parv. I mean, the Beverly Brothers, they stuck around for a few years. Just getting back to, just before we touch on them again, getting back to the coach, John Tolos. He did have a run after this in, not memorably at all, in the UWF, the Universal, the Herb Abrams UWF.
Right.
Herb Abrams, great fringe character. If anyone's not heard of him, you should really look up Herb Abrams and his whole kind of career in wrestling. But he managed at the time Bob Orton, Cactus Jack and the Power Twins, and he was colour commentator as well on their TV show. So he may have done some commentary elsewhere as well, like you alluded to, Parv. But getting back to Burnley Brothers, the last time the coach managed them was, I don't know if you've ever seen that really awful-looking spot where they spike someone's head on, like, you know, a flapjack-type manoeuvre. Yeah. It looks quite brutal, actually. That's the coach's final TV appearance, was at ringside then.
Oh, right, OK.
So that's the kind of the only memorable thing I've got.
I want to say that John Tolos was one of those guys who went to Hawaii a lot. You know, like Lord James Blears and those.
Oh type God, Jerry! I don't. Did he ever do many tours in Japan early?
I haven't seen much of John Tolos in the ring at all. But I want to say that he's one of those guys who hung out in Hawaii. That, you know, that old Pacific promotion.
Yeah, no. I kind of get that vibe from him as well.
I feel like he, you know, guys like him, Sam Steamboat is that sort of figure. You know, King Curtis Iaukea.
Hanging out on the beach all day, playing at night, living the life.
Don Morocco once in a while, you know. Bockwinkel comes into town, you know, a couple of times a year. So that's. I mean, I want to say like Peter Maivia was big in that territory.
Yeah, that was apparently a really great territory to work because you know they chill out on the beach all day, they train, they tan, and then they, you know, go and work, you know, a small loop, you know, on the main island.
And essentially, just wrapping up on the coach, he basically sold both contracts to the genius, didn't he, before he left?
Yes. We may touch on more contract manoeuvrings elsewhere, but yeah, another time when there was no reason why he sold, he didn't say, well, I'm going to do X, Y, or Z. It was just kind of the genius took over, you know, the management of the Bevs.
Yes. Okay, well, I'm sure somebody one day will ask us about the genius, so we'll come back to that. But for now, let's go over the event center with JT Rosero.
Let's take you down to the event center.
Thank you, Parv and Alan. JT Rosero here inside the event center. Here on episode 6 of Letters from Kayfabe, and looking back around this time in 1990 is where we want to go tonight, looking at Saturday Night's Main Event number 28, aired October 13th, 1990, taped about a month earlier, September 18th, in Toledo, Ohio. And this was an episode that always stood out to me for a couple of reasons. One, it had a really cool atmosphere because it was the Oktoberfest episode. So they're at a big Oktoberfest festival. They keep cutting back there. You get the genius stuffing sausage with his big blonde wig and all kinds of stuff going on. The Bushwhackers marching around. But a big dichotomy to the fun was the very empty in-ring work in the company around this time. Here's the card. The Ultimate Warrior and the Legion of Doom finished off Demolition in about 5 minutes, and that was pretty much it for the original Demolition. They would show up at Survivor Series, and then Axe would be gone after that, but all intents and purposes, they're pretty much cooked by this point, so not a lot of excitement around that match. Randy Savage beats Dusty Rhodes by a countout at 9:30, and of course, that is the infamous episode where Ted DiBiase shows up ringside and beats up Dusty's son, Dustin. So a great moment, not a great match. Hulk Hogan and Tugboat defeated Rhythm and Blues by disqualification. Sergeant Slaughter knocked off Coco Beware, and Texas Tornado defeated Haku. And the reason I just wanted to call this out was just to call out this time period, because to me it's a very interesting one. The Ultimate Warrior was now on top as champion. Hulk Hogan, pretty much in the semi-main event, had missed most of the summer, and ratings were heading south. Houses were heading south as well. Of course, many blame to the Ultimate Warrior. Some blame the lack of competition for the Warrior. But if you look at the depth of the roster at this point, it was very hurting on many levels. I think people were rebelling a bit about Hogan not being the champion. Warrior, again, not having that competition. The tag team scene was taking a bit of a dip. And you could see that they were starting to flesh out some of the old guard and mix things up a bit. And as we head into 91, things definitely start to turn over. By a year later, it looks like a whole different company. And this Saturday's Main Event always stood out to me. It's really one of the last of the original incarnation. They had one more in April. But really, this was the last of the, like, either monthly or at least every other month episodes. It was kind of a callback to the early ones with the heavy, heavy camp. And that part stood out. But again, just this card to me is a real snapshot of the dark downtime that the company was in when it came to in-ring talent. So I just wanted to head back that since it was about 16 years ago this week. So otherwise, be sure to check out the rest of the episode here tonight. It's going to be a good one. We're going to be looking at the management decisions of Bobby the Brain Heenan. So always a great topic when you can dive into the insights and thoughts behind what was going on in a manager's mind. Be sure to check out every episode of every podcast and every written piece at PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world. We have four feeds for you on iTunes, the Place to Be Podcast, PWO-PTBN, PTN Pop, and the Kevin Kelly Show. And you can follow us on all forms of social media by just searching Place to Be Nation. So I'm going to toss things back over to Parv and a chap called Alan. I am Justin Rosero. We'll talk to you next week.
All right. Well, thank you for that, Mr. Rosero. Fascinating as ever. And now, Alan, I think it's time for our long topic.
Yes, and this is a question asked by Bradley D'Amato of Benslem, Pennsylvania. So thank you very much for the question, Bradley. And it's, over the years, Bobby Heenan made a lot of different decisions as a manager. How would you assess various dealings? What were his best and worst decisions? So that's quite a meaty question there, Parv, because Bobby Heenan had a fair few kind of dealings and people he managed, didn't he?
Yeah, well, I mean, he was effectively in the WWF for 9 years, from 1984 to 1993, and all throughout that time, he was a major, major character in storylines, involved with many, many different people. And we looked into this into some depth, didn't we, Alan? So we wanted to give as thorough an answer as possible. So what we're going to do here is I'm going to go through point by point the main sorts of things he does during his entire run. And then I'm going to ask you, Alan, what you make of the decision. Okay?
Okay.
So he first comes in 1984, and his first purchase, contract purchase, is from Fred Blessy. He picks up Big John Studd. And immediately goes into a feud with Andre. What do you think of picking up Stud? Somebody he'd worked with in previous walks of life in Georgia and the AWA. But what do you think of picking up Stud? Not a bad first charge?
No, not at all. I mean, Stud was always positioned at the top of the card. I mean, if you want to come in and manage someone, it's, you know, you want someone who's going against one of the main attractions on the road, and Andre certainly fit that bill in his era. So taking Big John Stud... So really, I mean, with Heenan was a great talker and he could put over people, and this is why he was given certain people. But would you say that Stud needed Heenan? You know, was Stud a good talker on his own?
Stud's an all right talker. I want to say that Big John Stud's got a bit of that Beverly Hills business about him as well. So I think, again, obviously Blessy was the Hollywood flesh and plate, so maybe it's like the LA connection coming in again, like, you know, looking deep into the kayfabe there. Let's look at some of the other people he picks up around this time. He gets Ken Patera, also coming in from the AWA. He also picks up Missing Link, who has a kind of blink and you'll miss him cup of coffee type run, and Paul Orndorff. But his stint with Orndorff wasn't very long, because Orndorff fired him at the very first Saturday night's main event, where he sided with Hulk Hogan. So Orndorff fired him there on April the 27th, 85. Ken Patera also wasn't long for the Heenan family, because he left the WWF, of course, in May of 1985 to serve jail time after various misunderstandings at a branch of McDonald's, famously. So I think these are all things out of Heenan's hands, aren't they? He acquired the services of Adrian Adonis in July of 85. That's July the 9th. Now, here's a big decision, Alan, and I want you to get your teeth stuck into this one. September the 9th, 85, he trades the Missing Link and Adrian Adonis to Jimmy Hart in exchange for King Kong Bundy. Now, do you think that's a fair swap?
I think that's a great bit of business there by Heenan. You know, in the trade markets, there again with Jimmy Hart, Missing Link. You know, pretty much. You know, at that point, he was a one-trick pony. Adrian Adonis piling on the pounds. Maybe Heenan thought he's going to be moved down the card. So taking someone like King Kong Bundy under his wing, and then, you know, out of this, you got King Kong Bundy a main event, you know, shot and run versus Hogan at WrestleMania 2. So without that, what would he have had with Missing Link? Someone who didn't do much at all after this point, and an Adonis who was a better fit, really, for Jimmy Hart, you know, at this stage of his career.
Yeah, and I would say probably that, you know, main event at Mania 2 was probably the highlight that, you know, he took Bundy to the height of his career as well. So it was just a good move for King Kong Bundy there, I would suggest, too. Even though it was a losing effort, still, you know, catapulted him into the limelight. So the next person to join the Heenan family was Harley Race. He comes in May the 13th of 86. Now, if you were a manager in early 1986 and you were, you know, looking at the old transfer market there, Alan, Harley Race comes up as a free agent. Snap him up.
Well, it's like nowadays in world football with Manchester United, it's like going for Zlatan Ibrahimovic. You know, someone who's been around, who's a proven guy, who can do the business, won titles everywhere. And, you know, he comes in, you want to snap a guy like that up. And that's exactly what Harley Race was. He was, a multiple-time NWA world champion coming into the WWF. I think it was, a great fit. And he was bestowed, he was given the King title around this point as well, wasn't he? What we've touched on.
Yes, we discussed that in some detail a few weeks ago. I think back on episode one, actually. So go back and listen to that if you haven't. Let's move on, because Paul Orndorff once again joins the Heenan family, by this time of turning on Hulk Hogan, July the 19th, 1986. Now, one thing I'll ask, if you were Bobby Heenan, would you accept Orndorff back into the organization after, you know, he publicly fired you a year earlier?
Well, you wouldn't treat him the same, would you? You wouldn't have the same respect for Paul Orndorff and, you know, what he stood up for. Because Orndorff at this point, you know, was all over the show. He was, you know, WrestleMania 1, and then he turned face, and he was Hogan's kind of right-hand man. Hogan always had to have one of them, didn't he, with him throughout his career. And Orndorff, you know, had that role at one point. And he turned heel again and aligned himself back with Heenan and, you know, to go, you know, go after Hogan again. So it was basically, we'd seen it once before, really, hadn't we? And they tried to go with that again.
I think Paul Orndorff is a fair-weather friend. That's what I think. So yeah. October the 28th, 1986, he purchases the contract of Hercules from Slick. What do you think of this as a piece of business?
Well, you know, you need someone, you know, hired muscle there, someone who can do your bidding, your minion. And I think Hercules, you know, fit that perfectly. Hercules was someone that was, you know, tossed around, you know, like, just like a possession during his WWF run at points, wasn't he?
Yes, and we may come back to that in a moment. Big John Studd now leaves the WWF for a time. I think he may have even picked up an injury, I want to say, in November the 15th, 1986.
Yeah, so, was he back at any point after this until 89?
He does come back a bit later, which I will get to. Because famously he wins the Royal Rumble in 89.
Yeah.
Current around this time, it's Race, Orndorff, Studd. Studd has left, so Hercules. So really, he needs to pick up a bigger name, and he does that promptly in February of 1987, when Andre the Giant turns on Hulk Hogan on an edition of Piper's Pit, which we discussed last week, to become the latest member of the Heenan family, and he would be associated with them for some time. What do you think of picking up Andre?
Yeah, I mean, Andre is a heel. You needed someone to talk for him. And I think Heenan was arguably the best talker at the time in WWF, if not as a mouthpiece in the business as a whole. And I think they worked really well together. Heenan would brag and brag and brag about what Andre was going to do to Hogan. And it was great, you know, to see the comeuppance, you know, more for Heenan because of the comedy and, you know, the excuses he'd come up with as well, because you didn't really want Andre losing face in a way, even though with it he lost. So Heenan is the perfect kind of foil for that, as, you know, the buffoon in the relationship kind of worked a little bit.
Now, do you think the WrestleMania 3 would have been like the peak of Heenan, like the main event there?
As a manager, yes, because, you know, after this we had WrestleMania 4, where he wasn't involved in the title as a manager, WrestleMania 5 where he wasn't, WrestleMania 6 where he wasn't, 7, yeah, that's it, wasn't it? He was involved in the first three in some ways, but then after that he wasn't, you know, a main event manager as a top one maybe.
He wasn't involved in that very, very top main event storyline.
No, but to be fair to him, he was, you know, on TV a lot as well, not as a manager, more as a host or co-host.
Okay, yes. More on this in a moment, because in May of 1987, May the 30th, he picks up a tag team, the Islanders. So that's Haku and Tama. And also boosting numbers around this time, because Paul Orndorff gets injured somewhere around this point, from May, June of 87, and Heenan promptly replaces him with ravishing Rick Rude. Wasn't long before Orndorff comes back for a second time, August the 22nd, 87, and Orndorff promptly fires Bobby the Brain for the second time and starts feuding with Rick Rude. So after this point, you'd never employ, you'd never want to manage Orndorff again, would you?
No, you wouldn't have any association with the turncoat. You know, good riddance. And I think Rude came out on top in that feud.
And what do you think about Rick Rude as an acquisition in 87? You
know, spotting, I think that's
young talent.
Brilliant. You know, Rude fresh off his tag team run in the in Crockett and in the NWA, you know, coming in here, highly touted singles guy. And they really worked well, you know, with each other for, you know, the whole of Rude's run, really. I think he was associated with Bobby Heenan. And, you know, I really enjoyed them as a pairing.
And the Islanders, a solid tag team?
Yeah, the Islanders in 87, they weren't really featured much on in pay-per-view matches. They were more a TV tag team. They were all right. Nothing really stood out to me with their relationship with Heenan until later on, I think.
Yes, I would say that the key acquisition there in hindsight would be Haku, but we'll discuss that in a bit. February the 25th of 88, King Kong Bundy leaves.
Just before that, he lost out on someone in a bidding war, didn't he?
Yes, of course, yes. Well, Bam Bam Bigelow had come to the WWF, and basically all of the different managers were trying to, you know, bid for his services. So Heenan, Slick, Fuji were all involved in this bidding war, Jimmy Hart, of course, but ultimately they would all lose out to Oliver Humperdinck. And it was actually Oliver Humperdinck who picked up Paul Orndorff after he fired Heenan. So, yes, all of this happened kind of in late 87, around the time of that Rude Orndorff feud. What do you think of losing out to Humperdinck? A low point for Heenan?
Well, definitely. I mean, Humperdinck was a face manager, low on a totem pole, but he did have relationship previously, I think, with Bigelow in I don't know where they were together, maybe was it Florida? I'm sure they've had some associations before, and I think afterwards as well in the NWA when he had that run in 88 later on, after this WWF run, but I think there was some association there, so maybe Bam Bam going with Humperdinck was the fit.
Yeah, and if I was King Kong Bundy around that time, if I saw my manager trying to pick up Bam Bam Bigelow, I think the writing was on the wall. So I'm not surprised to see Bundy leaving there in February of 88. So so it's around this time, in January to February of 88, that Heenan would play the transfer market some more. He sold Andre the Giant's contract to Ted DiBiase for the princely sum of $1 million, Alan. Good piece of business.
Amazing piece of business. That I think that would have shattered the transfer record. You know, to be totally honest, $1 million contract, Ted DiBiase. Obviously, DiBiase coming in, flashing the cash. Heenan, you know, saw that he could take DiBiase here, and it was an astute bit of business, really, from Bobby.
Yes, well, wait till you get this next bit of business, because on April the 17th of 1988, on an edition of Wrestling Challenge, Heenan reveals that he's once again the manager of Andre the Giant, and later it was revealed that he'd bought the contract back for the cut price of $100,000. So what do you think of Andre's price diminished? Is that Andre's price going down, or just a rich man, you know, done with his plaything?
Rich man done with his plaything, I think. I mean, it's pretty hard to keep Andre on the road, and you know, all the fees that come in with that, and all the beer and the handlers that he would need. So I think it was a headache for Ted and his manservant Virgil. So I think for him it served a purpose. He got the belt for a short time. He was managed to buy that as well. But then I think, like you said, plaything over, went back to be managed by Heenan.
Yeah, but I mean, the Megabucks kept on going all the way to SummerSlam, and Heenan's involved in that. So they kept the relationship going. But yeah, I actually think the Heenan took Ted to the cleaners a bit over that whole business. But I guess he's got more money than sense.
Yeah, $1 million man, he's got plenty.
So the March the 3rd, 88, and Harley Race got seriously injured against Hulk Hogan. And then another blow to the Heenan family, May the 7th, Tama left the WWF. So depleted numbers here. I think they're right down to Andre and Rude at this point. Anyone else left?
Andre, Rude, and Haku we're going to talk about yes. in a minute, really.
Yes, because it's Haku, of course, who would be crowned the new king. Oh, and of course, they still had Hercules in the Heenan family knocking around.
the utility man.
The utility man Hercules, and that is, in fact, his next bit of business, because maybe Heenan realized that Hercules was still in the family and promptly sold him to... Any guesses?
Was it Ted DiBiase? Ted DiBiase, sorry. Did he sell him into slavery?
Yeah, he did. October the 1st, 88, he sells Hercules into slavery. Now, what do you make of this? A shrewd piece of business by Heenan?
Well, yeah, I mean, he wasn't doing much with Hercules at the time. Hercules in 88 was just bumbling around lower mid-card. So, powering him off to DiBiase again, there was some great business there by Heenan.
I wonder because Hercules promptly turned on Ted, didn't he? So I wonder if there was like a cashback guarantee on that, because I'm guessing Heenan just ran away to the bank and Ted was left with a hostile Hercules on his hands. So he was almost money for nothing.
Maybe Hercules was being a little bit rowdy before that, and Heenan knew this, and you know Hercules' attitude, he wanted to get rid of him because of it.
I make it Heenan 2, Ted 0 here.
Yeah.
Okay, so he's pretty busy in October of 88, because on the Brother Love show a week later, he announces the Red Rooster is going to replace Hercules in the Heenan family. What do you make of this?
It's Bobby Heenan then showing that he can take any habanega, anyone that you know perceived as a jobber, and take them to superstardom. And this is what he tried to do with the Terry Taylor as the Red Rooster.
And then a couple of weeks later, October the 22nd of 88, brings in Arn Anderson and Tully Blanchard, the Brainbusters. One of his best signings to date?
Oh, definitely. I think maybe on par with Rude and just behind Andre there.
Yeah. I think if you were, you know, looking around who's coming up for availability, Arn and Tully is probably right at the top. You know, you don't see Slick or Jimmy Hart making moves like this.
No, they're going for you kind of lower end guys. These guys were destined for great things, and obviously Heenan knew that.
So, December of 88, this is where Big John Studd comes back, and Heenan basically claims that he's going to join the family again, but Studd wants absolutely nothing to do with them. So that's when Big John Studd becomes a hero, and they rerun the Andre feud with the roles reversed.
Yeah.
January the 1st of 89, Red Rooster fires Bobby Heenan. I think we discussed this last week, didn't we?
Yeah, it was kind of introducing what we're going to touch on in a minute, the Brooklyn Brawler. So he was being more obsessive to the Red Rooster. He was slapping him around, wasn't he? And, you know, Rooster had enough, and that's what happened that brought the Brooklyn Brawler in.
Yeah, so I just think that's a kind of little lower card angle that he was involved with for a while. But he really had bigger fish to fry, because in April the 2nd of 89, the date of WrestleMania, Rick Rude won the first gold for the Heenan family by beating the Ultimate Warrior for the IC title. What do you make of that? I mean, I popped big for that when I was a kid, because I was a big fan of the heels. What did you think?
Well, first of all, it's interesting that you said that's the first Heenan family title. You know, he didn't have anyone else with the title, did he, from 84 till 89? So 5 years, he was touted as, you know, the top manager, and they didn't, you know, there was no belts in the family.
Yeah, I mean, even when Andre won the belt, he was working for DiBiase, so
yeah,
can't even count that one.
So yeah, maybe his DiBiase bought the title, and that's what Heenan really wanted, to have a world title, but he never got it. Officially.
Yes. So anyway, it was around this time the Brooklyn Brawler also left the Heenan family, although this was never acknowledged on air. And just a couple of months later, July the 29th, 89, the Brainbusters defeat Demolition to win the tag titles. So the Heenan family's now got two titles under its belt.
Yeah, great little run here for the Heenan family in 89, picking up the second title. And I mean, a lot of people thought at the time the Brainbusters beating Demolition was, you know, quite the upset.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you wouldn't have thought it. The Demolition were kind of a rough and tumble team. The Brainbusters, more scientific wrestlers. And it tended to be those, you know, bigger fan favorites who'd win at the time. So anyway, the Brainbusters weren't long for the WWF. They left in November. And I think they traded the titles back to losing to the Hart Foundation? No, the Demolition again, wasn't it?
Yeah, and then I think Hart Foundation Demolition was some 90. I think.
Well, before that, of course, Haku and Andre the Giant beat the Demolition to win the tag belt.
Oh, no, they did, didn't they? Of course.
Yes. And yes, it's around this time in 1990 now. So obviously the Brainbusters have left, so he needs to pick up more charges. So we get another contract purchase, Alan, and I'm fascinated to know your verdict on this one. March the 10th, 1990, he purchases the contract of Barbarian from Mr. Fuji. Warlord, the other half of the Powers of Pain, was sold to Slick. And in fact, in an interesting little twist, Slick and Heenan managed the Powers of Pain jointly for a few matches after this before they went their separate ways. Who do you think got the better end of the deal there, Slick or Heenan?
Well, of course, Heenan again. Look at the Barbarian. He was around for years later in various incarnations. Not always managed by Heenan, obviously, but, you know, compared to the Warlord, who, you know, got stuck feuding with David Boy Smith for about 10 years, it seemed like later on, I think the Barbarian, you know, was the better acquisition of the two.
Yes, and just a little tidbit here. Around this time, I'll come back to this because it happens a little bit later in the year, but there's more on this story to come, this business with Fuji and the Barbarian. Watch this space. April the 1st, 1990, that's WrestleMania 6, Andre turns on Bobby Heenan on a dark day for the Heenan family here. Maybe the writing is on the wall. So what happens after that? May the 19th, and Heenan makes a surprise appearance at the finals of the Intercontinental Championship Tournament. A final between Mr. Perfect and Tito Santana, when they reveal that Mr. Perfect now has the perfect manager. So he loses Andre a big blow and then almost immediately replaces him with Mr. Perfect. Good replacement?
Yeah, Mr. Perfect, younger guy than Andre. Andre's, you know, run at the top was, you know, coming to an end. So I think picking up Mr. Perfect, who he would probably assume would take him into the 90s as his perfect manager, was a fantastic fit.
But now in October 87, another dark day in 1990 with the Heenan family, because President Jack Tunney suspends Rick Rude indefinitely for making derogatory comments about the Big Boss Man's mother. We will probably have to return to the presidential decisions of Jack Tunney one day, Alan. But a bitter blow for Heenan losing a loyal servant here in Rude.
Oh, yeah, definitely. But I think Heenan got his own back on Rude because obviously he lost out on him. So he probably convinced the WWF to keep advertising Rude on the house shows, even though that he knew Rude wouldn't appear. So it would make Rude look bad and hopefully get, you know, a bump of money for Heenan, maybe. So, you know, that might have been Heenan's revenge ploy. You never know. So when Rude thought it was Vince all along, maybe it was Heenan because he was felt jilted.
December the 15th, 1990, and he used his old connections with the Million Dollar Man to help pay off the ref, to help Mr. Perfect win the Intercontinental title back off the Texas Tornado. Little known bit of business this, but if you've ever seen that match, Ted DiBiase slips a couple of $100 bills in the referee's pocket there, and they get a crooked win over the Texas Tornado.
Bit bizarre, really. Why couldn't Heenan, could he not afford this at the time? And, you know, getting DiBiase, surely anyone could afford in a couple of $100s. Why did he have to go to DiBiase for it?
I don't know, but it seems to me that Ted has picked up the flag for a third time here. 3-0 to Heenan. This is an ongoing thing. I think Heenan's got the better of Ted every single time in their business dealings.
No, I think you're right.
Okay, so basically, Heenan starts to concentrate a lot more on his broadcast career, as we've already mentioned, around this time. And in June the 3rd, 1991, because of his obligations as a broadcast journalist, he allows Mr. Fuji to manage the Barbarian against Bret Hart. I think this was at Madison Square Garden. And, of course, it was a losing effort for the Barbarian. And Heenan blamed Mr. Fuji for it, triggering a little-known feud across the summer. And I mentioned Holy Grails, Alan. Did you know that Heenan and Fuji ended up having a singles match in August of, or October of 91, I want to say, at the Nassau Coliseum to blow off this feud? I mean, did you ever know this feud even happened?
I heard about it, but very recently, maybe in the last 6 months, this happened. I posted a GIF the other day. I think I posted it to yourself, Parv, as well, of when Fuji threw salt at Heenan on commentary at an MSG show.
Yes.
So there was an interesting feud there between, you know, two heels. So you didn't often see two heel managers feuding like that, did you, in the WWF?
Yes, and all across the house shows, Haku and the Barbarian would face off against Fuji's charges, and even Fuji in the ring himself. So, very interesting. That was actually Bobby Heenan's last match in the ring against Mr. Fuji. Just an interesting thing to contemplate. And we've talked about Holy Grails. That is one match that I would give anything to see, I think. Maybe not quite kind of, you know, Ted DiBiase being ripped off by Heenan levels. I wouldn't give that much, but I would... I'd pay a pretty penny, I reckon. So if anybody's got that footage, get in touch. And then June of 22nd, 1991, this is when Perfect and Heenan were guests on the funeral parlor. And it's when Coach is brought in, as we discussed earlier on the show, Alan. And that essentially triggers the end of the Heenan family. Haku and the Barbarian would hang around till January of 92, but they were effectively gone as well. They did a lot of Japan dates, so they went on TV a lot, and they were on the house shows with the Fuji guys. However, Heenan was still around till 93, and he would still keep his finger in the management pie. Of course, he was instrumental in bringing in Ric Flair in late 1991, and he pulled all the strings to make Mr. Perfect his executive consultant at ringside, so he kind of had a proxy there. Ric Flair essentially had two managers, didn't he?
Yeah. What was Heenan's title? I mean, I know the executive consultant was Mr. Perfect. Was he the he was the finance, wasn't he?
He was the financial consultant, yeah. The executive the financial consultant and the executive consultant. There's some very memorable stuff. That's one of my all-time little favorite heel trios there, Alan.
Oh, definitely.
Flair, Perfect, and Heenan. That they're just a match made in heaven. They're the real match made in heaven from 1991.
Yeah, no, they were fantastic all the way through, with Heenan on commentary throughout, always putting Flair over. I mean, especially Royal Rumble 92 is an all-time favourite, you know, Royal Rumble match and match in general, and commentary. For me, Heenan, you know, at various stages, begging, pleading, gloating, crying, laughing, you know, it went through the full range of emotions with him. And I think that was one of his finest moments on commentary as well, around this time, if not, you know, throughout his entire career.
Yes, and I also really love, I love the moment after they have lost the belt to Savage at WrestleMania 8. You know, one time means nothing to my career. That's such a fantastic, probably one of the all-time best interviews to take place on WWF television, I'd suggest. I just think that's phenomenal. You know, all three of those guys are on absolute fire during that run. You know, Heenan like kicking cans and they're just brilliant all the way through that stuff.
Yeah.
And then in 1993, of course, he also is instrumental in bringing in Lex Luger from the WBF, And I think that's his last kind of pulling of the strings behind the scenes before he's ousted from WWF television by Gorilla Monsoon. So, yes, overall, if you had to make an assessment on Heenan's management decisions, thumbs up or thumbs down, Alan?
Well, definitely overall, it's thumbs up. I mean, he got the better of Ted DiBiase three times. and, I mean, the only time really where he lost out on something was Bigelow to Humberdink. Every other time he did well with trades and getting people in. Yeah, I think overall he was the most successful heel manager in this period. The only person close would be Jimmy Hart, really, wouldn't it?
Yes, and I think Jimmy Hart was a... I mean, I don't know. He maybe had comparable success with the Honky Tonk Man and the Hart Foundation winning gold. But I feel like Heenan generally got the better deals and the bigger wrestlers, the bigger names.
And he could put himself over on TV as well a lot, so that kind of helped him overall with his standing in the WWF.
Absolutely. Just before we wrap up on Bobby Heenan, I thought it might be fun, Alan, to have a look at some of the different versions of the Heenan family and maybe rank them, maybe make an assessment as to which is the best version of the Heenan family over the years.
Yeah, that sounds fun.
Okay, so the first iteration, that kind of early, you know, the 84-85 version, where you had Big John Studd, Ken Patera, Missing Link, Adrian Adonis, and Paul Orndorff, let's say, around the same sort of time. If you just give a rating out of 10 for that version of it, and maybe we'll do it that way, what would you give that one?
Probably about a 4 or a 5. My kind of thing is with stables of wrestlers is, could you see them hanging around together? Could you see them all as a group going out, you know, with Heenan celebrating, you know, after a show? And Studd, Patera, Missing Link, Adonis and Orndorff, I couldn't see, you know, that mixture of guys all being a coercive unit. So, you know, I'd give that one 4 out of 10.
Doesn't seem to be a lot of team cohesion there, I'd agree. 86 to 87 now. King Kong Bundy, Harley Race, Ravishing Rick Rude, Andre the Giant and the Islanders. What do you make of that?
I like this one, really. I think, you know, where you've got Andre and Bundy, who, you know, both, you know, big men. You had, you know, the classic wrestler in Race. You had the up-and-coming, you know, ace in Rude. And, you know, the Islanders are there to make up the number. I think that, you know, I would give them a solid 7 out of 10 for that version.
Okay, well, then you had this little period in 1998 where they were really down in numbers, and they were down to just 4. Andre, Haku, Hercules, and Ravishing Rick Rude.
Yeah, they are depleted somewhat, aren't they?
Yeah, a downgrade on the previous, a less... What would you give them out of 10, those 4?
I would probably give those 4, because you've still got Andre in the mix and you've still got Rude, and, you know, Haku's, you know, ever dependable for years with Heenan. You know, I'd give them a 6. Hercules is, you know, just the guy that's there.
I would say also that King Haku is probably an upgrade on Haku the Islander as well.
Definitely.
Okay, now we have the late 88-89 version. Andre the Giant, Haku, Ravishing Rick Rude, and the Brainbusters. Briefly, of course, you also got the Red Rooster and Brooklyn Brawler, but I'm not even sure if they're canon members of the Heenan family. I don't ever recall them hanging out with the others, you know.
No, not on promo shots, laughing in the background, being interviewed by Sean Mooney. This is my favourite one. I don't know about yourself, Paul, but I'd give these guys, Andre, Haku, Rude, and the Brainbusters, you know, I'd give them a 9 out of 10. My favourite kind of, you know, era of the Heenan family. What was yours, Parv? Is it this one?
Oh, I mean, yeah, you just look at those, you know, Arn Anderson, Tully Blanchard, Rick Rude, Haku and Andre. I mean, how cool do they look together? You know? Yeah. And I always thought it was a travesty that, because they're pictured on the back of that Survivor Series famously, aren't they?
Yeah.
And it's a travesty that Tully can't make that, because they look so cool on the back, all standing together.
Yeah.
So anyway, then you get the final iteration, really, of the Heenan family after WrestleMania 6 when Andre leaves. It's Mr. Perfect, Ravishing Rick Rude, Haku. I mean, Rude and Haku seem like they're ever-present, really, don't they? And the Barbarian. So this is comparable, I guess, to the diminished numbers 88 version. But an upgrade on them?
No, a slight upgrade. I know that we've lost Andre. We got Perfect, but Harkoon Barbarian going on to, you know, good success later on as the Faces of Fear in WCW. You know, a tough team. So I like this. I like this foursome with Perfect and Rude as well. So I'd probably give them 7.5 out of 10.
Okay. Yeah. So roughly speaking, our top version is the 88, 89. You know, the Brainbusters one. One thing that interested me is how loyal Haku was throughout. Like, he's basically,
and Rude, it's Haku and Rude, they're the two stalwarts, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, they stay all the way really from
86,
87 all the way to the end. So yes, that's the Heenan family. Why don't you write in and tell us what your favorite version was? I mean, I think roughly speaking, we got the right, you know, those guys were around at the same time, weren't they? So
yeah, pretty much. I mean, there could be some slight crossover on all of them, and I think we covered this quite well, haven't we, Parv?
Yeah, if I was to make like a best of Heenan family, I think Rude and Haku have to be there because they're always in it. But I would always picture Perfect in the Heenan family too, even though he joins quite late.
Yeah, and Andre.
Andre is pretty much, you know, I would probably make those four like the most Heenan family-ish members of that period.
I agree.
All right, well, I think that was quite fun. If people want to write in with other such questions, how can they get hold of us?
They can get hold of us on Twitter is the best way. And for myself, it's at @Alan_cheapshot, and that's spelled A-L-L-A-N. As we've mentioned before, you can follow me as well for Honest Day in History, which I cover what happenings and matches and clips and links and all sorts of fun stuff like that on my Twitter feed. So come and check that out. And how can we send you messages, Parv?
Well, you can get me on @JerryVonK at Twitter. You can also try to find me on the Pro Wrestling Only boards or on the Facebook, where we're on the PWO PCBN page. If you just do a search for that, it will come right up. And we look forward to answering more of your questions next time on Letters from Gayfabe.
See you around.
My favorite color, green. Where is my money?
Your money's up. Oh, wait. Before I give you your money, why don't you accept my personal check?
Hey, wait. Whoa. I told you, brother, I don't deal in nothing but cash.
Well, if I'm paying cash for Hercules, it's well worth
it. Hey, Dr. Hercules Hernandez is the greatest commodity in professional wrestling. I wouldn't even be selling them to you if it wasn't for all this money.
Well, you're going to get your money.
Which I'm waiting on.
I'd like my withdrawal, please.
Yes, Mr. Heenan. Right,
so whoa, brother.
Well, what's the problem, baby?
Since you're getting all this cash, I'd like the contract to Hercules.
Oh, I'm sorry. Hey, you know the slicks to take care of business. There you go,
dude. Well, so does the brain. One moment, please. Okay, there's your cash, Slick. By the way, how are you getting at home? How are you getting at home?
Oh, everything's cool, baby. Hang loose. There you go.
Always prepared, huh?
Yeah, you know that. The slicks,
well, you want, let's rake it in here.
Say, man, let me drop my money on the floor.
Don't worry about it. It's all clean. You can't get money dirty. You should know that.
Hey, this is the way I love to go shopping.
Where's you doing business with?
Hey, you know, Daddy. Adios, brother.
Take care.
You got it.